Okay, it's a real distinct privilege to have Rabbi Yerachmiel Fried here to speak with us. Rabbi Fried, not only the Rosh Kollel of the Dallas Kollel of Dada, he is a world-class Talmud Chacham, author of many books. We happen to be learning right now, finishing up Psachim and learning Arve Psachim. So he wrote a sefer on the chapter called Arve Psachim Minchas Erev. He wrote the sefer on the laws of Yom Tov Sheni in the diaspora, Yom Tov Sheni Kehilchoso. And I remember when we first went out to Seattle, there was a question, a person who lives in Israel, could he lay on a Yom Tov Sheni? Pulled out your sefer, didn't know you yet, but that told us the halacha. He wrote the book guiding people in Hashkafa and Musar, learning from the Ramban on Chumash. It is used in yeshivas all over the world. And he's currently writing what will eventually be the Sefer on the laws of Gerus and conversion. And we spent some time in the Kollel learning, teaching, Rabbi Fried teaching everybody. And from that and from many, many, many hours of learning and tshuvas, he's writing the Sefer. I have a great privilege of serving with him on the Beis Din. Rabbi Fried is the Av Beis Din. He's been teaching us and instructing us. He's an unbelievable mentor, very patient, and it's an incredible privilege to have a person like this here in Dallas with us and to have us have him in our shul tonight. Rabbi Fried.
Thank you very much, and please don't believe everything you hear. First of all, if I'm arrested for speaking here tonight, I plead not guilty. It's a pleasure to be here and to have a chance to share a few words about my Rebbe, Rav Shlomo Zalman, Albrecht, Zechus Sadach Lebracha, who a week from tomorrow will be his 19th Yahrzeit. And so, you know, time flies, and this is something which the Jewish Observer, which came out that year that he passed away, this is an article that I wrote about him that a little bit about his life, just a glimpse. It was called, we called it a glimpse into the life of a giant in our time, which all you can do with people like this, people like of this caliber, all you can do is a glimpse. And no matter how much you're with them, how much you think you know, all we know at the best is a glimpse, if we're lucky enough to get that glimpse. The Gemara says that one of the great sages was asked, to what do you attribute your greatness? And he said, because I saw the back of Rabbi Meir. Sometimes just seeing the back of these people, that's enough just to have had any connection to them at all. We get our greatness from the back of them. And I say that many people, and sort of on those lines, many people's lives have been built on what I call the Bittelsmann, on the inconsequential time of these great people. So people, let's say little people like me, got built by just the ride home, right, Arbach, in between the yeshiva and getting to his house to start the next thing. So people like me, us little people, our entire lives are built just in the in-between stage of him, between the yeshiva and getting home. Mm-hmm. In the years that I had the privilege to drive him and to spend time with him during those times. So it's hard to know where to start. It's hard to even know what to talk about. There's so much. And I would just say that, first of all, without the work that I did with him, the particular the Sefer on Yom Tov Sheni, the second day of Yom Tov, so there would not have been a kollel in Dallas, and there would not have been the whole community that started down there, and all that's come out of it, because, first of all, I would not have been prepared for it, for this kind of a position. Number two, they wouldn't have known about me either. I think that I heard that when they were checking into getting me to possibly come here, so Oscar Rosenberg was given the English translation of Yom Tov Sheni to read, and from that he reached out to have me consider coming over. And then consulting with him about whether I should or shouldn't come to Dallas, and every step of the way, and all the and many minute details of what should be and what shouldn't be, and should I even do this? You know, to leave Israel to do this was in consultation with him. As a matter of fact, one of my rebbeim who just passed away recently, very tremendous, a very young, relatively young rabbi who also a lot of the advice in my life came from him. He just tragically passed away in just last few weeks in Israel. So at the time he said, like, how could you leave? How could you leave Israel? Like, how many people have the chance to have an open door policy to be able to walk into the house of Rosh Hashanah Zalman Arba? So how could you leave that? How could you give that up? So I said, well, either I listen to him or I don't. And he said I should go. So what's the point of listening to him if I'm not going to listen to what he says? And at the time when it came down to it, like when the call first came to come to Dallas or not, and so there was a lot of discussion going back and forth overseas and between Israel and Dallas, and finally I had quite a few questions, and I went into him to say, you know, I have this and this and this doubt. He said, first go see it, then we'll talk. Mm-hmm. So and then coming back and then seeing what there was here and seeing the thirst of the people to learn. And so his answer was, not everybody can do. Whoever can do, must do. That was sort of like the guiding light that in other words, yes, go, you got to go. I remember, you know, the book that I wrote was about Second Day Yom Tov. So before I left, I said, the Rosh Yeshiva, now the question finally applies to me. Do I keep 2 days Yom Tov or not? He said, what's the question? Of course you keep 2 days. Meaning, like, of course you're going to be an Israeli who is now living in the diaspora. Of course you keep 2 days. So I said, no, I said, I only plan to go for 3 years and come back. He said, no, you're going there and you're staying. You're going to be successful and you're going to stay there. You're not coming back. You keep me 2 days. So I said, but I can't stay more than 3 years. It's, you know, at the time, you know, we're leaving, you know, Jerusalem schools. My daughter's 6 years old. More than 3 years, it's a co-ed school. You know, we couldn't really stay any longer than that. We're going to come back. You'll find a way. You'll work at something out for chinuch for your kids, and you're going to stay there, so you keep 2 days. Mm-hmm. So then I started saying a couple other arguments, and he said, that'll work out too. You're going to stay there to keep 2 days. So I started saying another thing, and he got angry. He said, well, you don't want to keep 2 days? I said, I want to do what's right. So you want to do what's right, you keep 2 days. So he had, you know, that clarity of vision of what's going to be. I think many questions as far as, like, it's impossible to even try to attempt to go into all the questions we discussed of you know, establishing a kahila, and whatever we did discuss, and we had the merit to discuss, certainly gave a guiding light of the way to view things and the way to look at things, the way the outlook, the way it should be, as far as, let's say, for example, an Erev. So I approached him with the question of whether there should or shouldn't be an Erev in Dallas, because I know it's a question of halacha many poskim have depending on certain streets, but really a more basic question. A lot of times, and I myself have seen in cities that when because of an Erev, people don't realize you can't carry on Shabbos. We had a story when I grew up in Indianapolis, or so there was a, it was after my time actually there, there was one of these shalichim that was sent from Israel to be a teacher in the school there. A lot of these people, they could be sort of orthodox, they're not really bad educated, and so this guy came from, there was at the time no Erev in Indianapolis, and this shalich, he walks out of shul, and he's carrying his talis. So he grew up in Israel, you know, his whole life he just came to America, and of course all the cities in Israel have an Erev around them. So he goes walking out with his talis, and they said, people started stopping him and say, you can't carry, there's no, you can't walk out with that, you know, there's no Erev. He never even heard the word Erev before, he just didn't, you know, he never... He said, he started screaming, what do you mean? What do you mean? My grandfather had a beard this long and he carried a Shabbos. What are you talking about? So they had to, like, sit down, try to explain to him, calm him down, and say there's an Arab. You know, you never know, like, people know, and people in Bala Tshuva, they might think they can carry. They don't know what the parameters are. You know, I would say Arab, you know, has to have no strings attached. So, but, you know, the borders and everything. So he said, he in complete, utter dismay and shock at my thought, the Habimina, he said, how can you expect the people to become observant and then stay at home? Like, are you out of your mind? You know, like, how can you? So, of course, that's been, not only can should it be an Arab, it's a mitzvah to make an Arab. You must make an Arab. Now, at the time, I didn't realize that they had just made an Arab right before I came. So, but since then, we've taken it over, and we're in charge of the Arab there, down there, and helped make the Arab up here, and so on and so forth. But I've always had been pushing and pushing, no matter where, you know, to get the Kol rabbis involved in setting up Arabs and watching over the Arabs, and because Rosh Hashanah gave this guiding light. Later on, I heard from a friend of mine who used to also drive him, and made it a point. I always had my little list of notes of questions to ask him. I always had, and I made sure to go to drive as slowly as possible, turn the 11-minute ride into like 20 minutes, you know, to make sure that if I have a chance of maybe, you know, getting through that light, to make sure I slow down a little bit so it'll turn red, so I can, you know, add another couple minutes onto the trip. And but this friend of mine made it a point of. He said he felt that the rabbi deserves a little bit of rest sometime in his life, so without somebody always badgering him. So he made it a point of never asking him any questions on his drive home. So because of that, Rosh Hashanah felt, he's helping me. Right? Just randomly tell him all kinds of stories and randomly just share with him stuff the whole way because he wanted to pay him back for the favor of driving him home. So he actually filled in part of the story of how he's so adamant about making an Erev that he said that the... And my friend told me, he shared this with me later on, that when the Erev was first built in Yerushalayim many, many years ago, Rav Shmuel Salant, one of the great sages of Yerushalayim, so he went to first get the support of the Rishon Letzion, the Sephardic chief rabbi, to, first of all, it's a monetary thing, and also to make sure that halakhically he supports it. And first he said yes, and then he called him back, and he said, I'm sorry, I can't support it, because the Sephardic opinion is that an Erev, unless it's an actual walls, doesn't work having a string. That's the opinion of the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch. That's the Sephardic opinion. Because of that opinion, he feels that he can't support it, and he's going to have to tell his Sephardic students not to follow by the Erev. So he's sorry he can't really support it. So Rabbi Shlomo Zalman said, because of that stringency, he said, we lost an entire generation of Sephardim. They completely gave up all of their observance, because it was too difficult to be able to force them to stay home with their kids and everything, so they threw out the baby with the bathwater. They threw the whole thing out, and so he said you have to know when to be smart and when to, you know, when to be stringent and when not to. So he was very, very, because of what this historical lesson that he learned from that generation. He was very adamant and very strong about that there should be an Erev. And we discussed Erev many times in many different perspectives, but that was like an example of that. I know it's been a guideline for me to always make sure that we do what we can, that there has to be an Erev. Another example was Chalav Yisrael. I discussed with him at the time that it wasn't attainable in Dallas. And so he gave me direction and guidance of, you know, that if it's difficult enough, so he told me when you should rely on Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's leniency of not keeping it, but by the same token, you should try to do whatever you can to get it there as soon as possible. And he pretty much set the guidelines for that and many other things for kashrus and other things that we'd be using in the city. Many people have asked me, how did it come about that I had this relationship? And I've thought many times, why me? And I can't really, until today, I can't answer that question. But I just, the story exactly of how it really came about was, I was a part of a group of Israelis that were asked to join the Skokie Yeshiva, Skokie, Illinois, for a year, to start a new kolo there to try to build up the yeshiva, which was doing very poorly at the time. It was close to collapsing, so they thought they'd bring in a kolo that'll strengthen the base medrash and strengthen the whole thing, and that will give. So there was a Moshe Hirschler Zatzal, a very great sage I was close with, asked me to join that group, and so I consented and came along. And so that year when we were there. So a couple things happened. First of all, I became AWOL from Israel because I was an Israeli citizen, and the government refused to recognize the reason I was there. So they made me AWOL, number one. Number two, we had all a group of Israelis that had no clue of what to do about the second day Yom Tov while we were there. You know, should we make a separate minyan for Simchas Torah or not, because Simchas Torah is a different day than for Americans. And there were myriad questions that came up that even the rabbis had no idea what to tell us, really. Like, it was just sort of like it was sort of a free-for-all, and we just never got clarity. So I sort of resolved in my mind that if I get the merit to come back to Eretz Israel, which my mother-in-law had to speak to a Haber Knesset to hold strings to get me back in, and was the whole thing, so I shouldn't get arrested the minute I get there. So I had to wait till I speak here tonight to get arrested. But I have a good lawyer. So that if I get back to Israel, I want to utilize the sages of Israel to I think that it's necessary. It's important to write a book. There should be a book out there on all the laws of traveling, and there should be a chapter also about the second day Yom Tov. That's the way I approached it. And I spoke to one of our rabbis, and he said, "Forget the rest of it. Just do Yom Tov Sheni." I said, "No, I'll just do a chapter on that. I think we need to cover all of traveling." So then I started getting involved in second day Yom Tov, and I used to always have, for many years I had, there's a Kol Torah, the yeshiva, Rav Shlomo Zalman's yeshiva is the yeshiva Kol Torah, a very famous yeshiva in Yerushalayim, very big yeshiva, and I sort of had an agreement with the mashkiach, with the spiritual dean there, that I wanted somebody to study with at night, so I'll be able to, learn strongly at night, and he had students, he had bachurim there that needed some strengthening, so we had sort of like a mutually beneficial deal that he would send me these sort of weaker students to learn with at night, and so I had my chavrusa, I had my study partner, and they had someone to strengthen them, and it was a good relationship. So as soon as I got back, I started working on the laws of Yom Tov Sheni, and I realized that I wanted to have someone, if I do this book, so I want, it should be as accepted as the safe, there was a predecessor, it's called Shmir Shabbos Gilchasa, the laws of Shabbos, which the author sadly just passed away this past year. Rav Neuber Zatzal, and it was universally accepted, really worldwide, because the main person he consulted with all these years was Rav Shlomo Zalman Arba, who was his Rebbe for many, 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 many years. So I saw that name is the name that the world is going to accept. So I need to get him involved in the Sefer. But I'm one of hundreds of Kol guys that would love to get Rav Shlomo Zalman involved in their Sefer. Like, who am I? I'm nobody. So first of all, like, I just started working on some of the subjects, and then I would go to his yeshiva or to his son's yeshiva. A few times I went to his son's yeshiva to ask him questions on Yom Tov Sheni. Now, it was far away from Yom Tov when I was asking these questions, so it was obviously, after one or two, three times I asked him questions about that, he started smelling a book. and another nudge that's out to nudge him to get involved in a book that he doesn't know who I am, he doesn't know who. So he basically, said, "Go ask from Shmuel, his son. I don't have time for this." And he's one little man with a whole generation trying on his shoulders. So so I realized that this is not going to work so well. So I asked him again, and he told me there's a sefer by Rabbi Yitzchak Flaxer, a certain rav. He wrote a sefer in Yom Tov Sheni. He'll answer all your questions. Go find that sefer. So I didn't realize, oh, there's a sefer about this already. So I went looking for it. It was totally out of print. It was impossible to get it. So I had to find the author, an elderly man who managed to go down in his cellar someplace and found an old copy with a ripped cover of this. He wrote a book on Yom Tov Sheni. So I opened it up and I saw 17 chapters on Yom Tov Sheni. I thought, okay, I have nothing to do. It's already done. But I started looking at it more carefully, and I saw that he brings throughout the Sefer, he brings halachas of he brings psukim, rulings of Rav Moshe Feinstein, and just brushes it off sort of like with a feather, just blows them off. As if, and I don't agree with that for this and this reason. He got me really angry. He got really angry, like, this is not right. And somebody has to get up and defend Rabbi Feinstein and, do more thorough job on this whole thing. But on the other hand, he already brought a lot of the source material that needs to be worked on. So I sat and started working on it. And I was very frustrated. I was working on it with my chavrusa. And I told my chavrusa, I'm so frustrated because I want to get Auerbach involved in these to really resolve some of these questions. And he doesn't want to talk about it. He said, "I have an idea for you." He said, "This bachur happened to be, Hashem has the hand of Hashem, this was very, very close with the Rosh Yeshiva, Shlomo Zalman. And he took it upon himself to make sure that Shlomo Zalman always has rides home. He used to walk a long walk to the bus stop. He's a simple person. He doesn't need a ride. He's the most simple person, the most humble person. So he used to take these long walks to the bus stop with Rav Neuwirth, and that's where Rav Neuwirth wrote the whole Shmir Shabbos Kachas, of taking these long walks every day from yeshiva to the bus stop and discussed it with the guy on the bus. And then he got on the bus like everybody else. And after that, he started getting too weak for that. So he started doing taxis. And until he got out to the taxi, so the taxi came, he was bombarded with questions, and that would make him so tired. And And then once this friend of mine, Chaim Suisa, he found out that the taxi driver was on a Friday or a Thursday, and he said that he asked a bracha from Shlomo Zalman that the Maccabi Tel Aviv game coming up on Shabbos, he asked a bracha that the Maccabi team should win. And Shlomo Zalman was so upset that they're playing on Shabbos and he's asking for a bracha for that. He was beside himself. This boy resolved, he's never again taking a taxi. We're making sure he has rides. And he especially somehow got money together and bought a little car for that. And then he started arranging people should have rides for him. So it was exactly Michael Russo that was arranging this. And he said, there's still one slot open, Tuesday's open. If you can borrow your mother-in-law's car, then I'll get you that slot. Okay, so I asked my mother-in-law, of course, you know, I'm in Mir Yeshiva, so I had to like get on the bus, come all the way back to Beit Vigan where we lived, to where the yeshiva was, and in the middle of the day, and borrow the car and go to the yeshiva. And I was scared to death because I had no idea. I don't know a single street in Yerushalayim besides the bus stop in front of my house, bus stop in my yeshiva, and everything in between. I had a sefer I read, and like I'm going to drive in Yerushalayim, you know, crazy. He said, "Don't worry about it. He'll tell you where to go, so you don't have to worry about it." So the first time I took him, this boy came with me, so everything should be safe, you know. And he went with, and we drove, and I didn't ask anything. I was nervous wreck driving for the first time in Yerushalayim. I'm nervous wreck, and I have the sage of the generation next to me in the car, and I'm, so I was asking the questions that day, and everything went well. Got home, got back to the yeshiva, dropped him back, car, everything's fine. And then after that, a few times came where I got there, and I'm one of who knows how many people that want to be the one that drives him home. He doesn't really know me yet, so like he doesn't really know it's serious, whatever. So I get there, I just buy the car, the whole thing, and someone else has already taken him. That happened once, twice, three times. I'm really about to give up, and then finally, oh, actually, he gets in the car. You know, he comes and I take him, and it was pouring rain, crazy rain. And he's telling me left, right, tells me exactly where to go. That was great until we got to his house. Where do I go now? So I know the general direction I have to get back to Beit Vigan, but every street in the center of town are all one-way little streets, and it's pouring down rain like crazy. And so I start driving, and I'm driving and driving, and I don't know how many times there was like a gyroscope going around in circles. So finally, instead of Beit Vigan, ended up in the Central Hotel in the middle of Yerushalayim. So I just had to stop and park in the Central Hotel for a minute just to get my bearings, and I was like, I decided, that's it, I'm done. And I realized, I remembered, hey, Central Hotel, Rabbi Shmuel First from Chicago, someone I had a connection with, a very great, one of the greatest rabbis in America today, is supposed to be in Israel now. I think he's staying in the Central Hotel. Maybe I'll go in and say hello to him. So I walk in there, and sure enough, he's there. I'm there anyway. I walk in. What's going on? I said, well, I'll tell you what. I have this thing with Rosh Hashanah and Arbach and this day that I'm supposed to be taking him, but it's over. I'm done with this. I'm finished with it. It's all this hassle, and it's not for me, the driving and this. And he said, let me tell you something. He said, when I was younger, so there was a great rub in Chicago when he was, and it was called the Weizener Rub, where Meisels, a great Holocaust survivor, a great sage, and he passed away. And he used to answer all the Nida questions for them. So he passed away. So first called up Moshe Feinstein and said, I'm a cold guy in Chicago, and the Weizener Rav passed away. I need someone to, there's no one to pass on my Nida questions anymore. Can I come to learn with the Rosh Yeshiva? He said, sure, come. So he got on the plane, came to, couldn't, poor guy, cold, got on the plane, went to Chicago. He said that he got on the subway. He didn't know where he was going either. And he got off where he thought he was supposed to get off. And he walks out, and the neighborhood didn't look that Jewish. And he's walking around, and you know, sort of feeling a little strange. And all of a sudden, a car screeches to a stop next to him. And there's a frum guy inside. The window comes down, and he says, "What are you doing here?" He says, "Get in." So he gets in the car, and the guy screeches off. He says, "What are you doing in this neighborhood? Are you out of your mind?" So somehow he ended up getting to Moshe Feinstein's house, and he said, from then on, he went for 2 weeks, every 6 weeks. To a Feinstein from Chicago. He said he couldn't afford it, and it was craziness and everything, but he said, I went, and look, now, he said, my whole life was built that way. I have 6,000 rulings written down for him. He has it in cards, you know, in subject order, and his whole complete life was completely changed. He said, you have something like this, and you're going to give it up? Don't you dare give it up. And when I come to Israel, I'm going to visit you, and I'm going to see your notes from Rav Auerbach. So Hashem somehow managed to get me right to the right place I needed to be to get that shmooze. So from then on, it sort of became, he sort of realized this is for real, and I started taking him. And then, so then once I'm in the car, so my friend had told me that once you're in the car, he's going to have so much appreciation for you that he'll answer anything you ask him. That's the point. So we got it, and that's really what turned out. So I started talking, and then after talking about it for a while, he realized how serious this is, and the total lack, the void in the halakhic literature of anything on Second Day Yom Tov, to the point that, you know, even the Rabbanim don't know what to do. So from then on, he not only did he answer me, but he really got involved. I can just show you,
for example.
These are actual papers. Anything he would say, he would tell me. So I would write it down. If you look carefully on all the papers that I wrote down, I gave it over to him. I'm embarrassed today. I gave it to him in handwriting, but I didn't know how to type. And so immediately, within a day or two, he would send it back to me through somebody with all of his. These are filled with his little annotations on every page. How exactly, you know, either to erase something or to add these words or those words, and to the precision, the incredible precision that everything should be said with such precise wording. And besides, he would add little annotations of sources and things like that here and there, but or restate things exactly the way he wanted them to be, that which led his son to write later on, one of the sages of the generation, Rav Shmuel Auerbach, that everything in the Sefer, in his father's name, is considered as if he wrote it himself, because he went over each word and he edited exactly how it should be. So he considered it as if he wrote it himself. That's the extent that he got involved. But it always was flabbergasting to me that how did he find the time to be able to go over everything I gave him and have it back within a day or two? Like always, I never had to wait for anything. Despite the fact that he has a huge yeshiva with hundreds of students and questions from around the world, and every single day, a huge line of people outside the door, to ask questions and meetings with people, and it was mind-boggling to see how that was possible. So out of that came, those rides came, this is the Sefer Yom Tov Sheni that came out of it, a 600-page Sefer, which there's almost not a page in here that he's not quoted at great length in the whole Sefer. And then, so some person, because it's somewhat foolish, when I finished the Sefer, I said, so I guess you're done driving, right? You're like, you have no need to drive anymore. You're finished. I said, are you out of your mind? I'll take every minute that I can get. So the
next Sefer that came up
was, I spoke about a lot of things, and I was going to put all the rest of the things besides Yom Tov Sheni in writing. So I happened to have worked first on the holidays. So his son, Rav Israel Auerbach, told me, if that's ready, put that out. Don't wait for the rest of it, which is very smart because I haven't got to the rest of it yet. This is quite a few years later. But all this is waiting this is all typed up and waiting to be worked on after the conversion safer. This is hopefully, Mir Sashem will be next. I've been waiting for a long time to do this, but this is all typed up in order of Shulchan Aruch, and it's enough for another 600-page safer. Once you come down to it. And this is just, again, this is just like in his off-the-cuff, on the rides. So, the impact, that he's had in so many different ways on the world, and I'm just talking for myself, just to see a person that is, first of all, of that level of greatness, that has also, Moshe Rabbeinu was known for who is the greatest man in the world, who is also the most humble man in the world. It's sort of mind-boggling how a person could have those two things, which is counterintuitive to think the two things could go together. But he was the Torah testifies that he was the humblest man that walked on the face of the earth, and that's the way it is with real our sages. That the Talmud says the greater our sages are, the more humble they are as well. So I guess it really depends what you compare yourself to. You know, if you compare yourself to people around you, Moshe would have been pretty haughty. But if you compare yourself to Hashem, so what am I? And that's the trick. And Rosh Zalman constantly was teaching lessons of humility just by every action that he did. Like one of the first times I took him, so if you drive, let's imagine you're driving the President of the United States to the White House. So you're going to just like say, stop and say, okay, see ya. You're going to get out of the car, go around, open the door, that's... So I get to his house, and I open my door to go around, and so he smiles at me and says, "Oh, you're coming to visit?" So with that smile, you know, he always had, "Oh, you know, I'm Tabata Vakiroti, you're coming to visit me in my house?" So I said, "No." He said, "It's okay, I know how to open the door by myself." So that's the way it was, and I tried maybe one more time, and I got the same kind of thing. So I gave up until the years went by. Then he became weaker. Then he really needed help to get, someone needed to help him get out of the car. So then he allowed me to come around to help him get out of the car. But otherwise, you know, the humility was just I guess the humility combined with the care for every other Jew. I mean, the stories of humility they go on and on and on. You know, he was so upset when people sent him letters and would write these like very high titles, calling him different, you know, the sage of the generation, the light of the generation, the pillar of the, there's all these flowery words that we write to these kind of people, and he would make a joke of it, or he would, you know, like everything in the book, every single thing in the book, the way anything I quoted him, I always made sure that he saw it first. So I also, when I was done with the entire book, but I wanted to make sure he saw the way that I'm thanking him also in the preface. So I'm not sure he's not going to be upset at me the way I'm thanking him. So I wrote there, it says, it's a special pleasure to express my thanks to the glory of the generation, the pillar of halacha, the pillar of guidance in halacha in our generation, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who went time after time over everything in his name and make sure that it's clear, and he put so much time, and I want to thank him for that. So he looked it over and he said, "Take out the time after time." Just he looks it over. That's good enough. Number one. And then he said, "And all these other titles you said, you can take those out also. Besides the fact they're all not true." So that's the only time I didn't listen to him in the whole book. The title stayed in. I think he knew that I'm not going to listen to that part too. So. He used to always ask me, many times he asked me, we were passing it, he knew I learned the Mir Yeshiva, which was on the other side of town, and so I sort of presented it like, without explicitly, you know, lying, I sort of like made it like I'm on my way to Mir Yeshiva, and I'm just taking him on the way, because if I'm going out of my way, he wouldn't even go. So, you know, and I never told him that I have to go, especially from Mir Yeshiva, to get the car, to take him, and he would like never even get in the car. So, but one time he gave me, just randomly, without asking it, randomly he gave me this whole shiur on the way about when you're allowed to lie to somebody. and it's okay in certain situations without directly addressing it, but I think he was trying to like tell me that it's okay. I know you're not telling me the truth, but it's okay. Like, you're allowed to lie to me about that. So I think, you know, he figured that one out. But you know, his caring for one time, we're driving, we're passing by the Shari Tzedek Hospital on the way home, taking him home, and at that time there was no buses that went on that whole street that went from Shtar Hutzel, from like the war cemetery all the way down to the Chevron Yeshiva, one of the great yeshivas. There's a pretty expansive. Some people would walk, there's no buses, or people would, the yeshiva guys would stand there and hitchhike. They get off. Up the hill, and they'd hitchhike, and they would a few miles down the way to get to the yeshiva. So people driving by, they pick him up, and in those days, you know, it was safe. Anyway, so I'm driving with him. Imagine you have the sage of the generation, and there's one yeshiva guy standing there with his finger out in Israel, they put the finger out, and he's saying, and it didn't cross my mind, I'm going to stop with Rosh Hashanah and I would pick up somebody, and, you know, pick up a hitchhiker with the Gadol Hador in the car. So, and this guy, I think he like sort of, he saw us in the car, and he sort of like took a step back also. And so he says, so I pass on by. So he looks to me in complete bewilderment, complete astonishment. He says to me in Hebrew, "Lama lo tzartolo? Why didn't you stop for him?" So I said, "I think he changed his mind." That didn't go very well. So then he says, and he says, "Why didn't you stop for him?" So I thought, okay, I know I'm in for it. I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. I'm going to keep my foot as far away from my mouth as I can, and I'm just going to just shut up and drive. And so he said, I don't understand. A Jew needs help. You have a whole back seat that's empty. You're going exactly where he's going. You could help a Jew. How could you not help him? Now, if I would have said, because you're in the car, either he would have jumped out of the car or thrown me out of the car or never gotten in again. But, so I just said, I'm just going to swallow, I'm just going to take this one. And, you know, needless to say, I didn't catch every red light I could. I was like trying to get home quickly, because the entire ride, it was like he was going on. He was like completely astonished. And then he stops talking to me. He's like looking at the windshield saying, I don't understand it. A Jew could help another Jew. It doesn't cost him anything. There's no extra trouble. And he doesn't have, I don't understand it. How could that happen? And that was like the entire ride all the way back to his house. So I was like shaking by the end of that ride. But that's a message I don't think I'll ever forget. And just the way someone like that looks at it, you know, like, for sure, like, he, like, because of him, you know, that should be a reason why I shouldn't, that it was, that I stayed away from that one. You know, or they see the sensitivity, like, let's say, one story, there was the Gulf War, back in the, it was like in the, like, 91, I guess, it was Gulf War. So a lot of Americans left, you know, it was pretty dangerous, and they kept on sending the warnings from the consulate to all the American citizens there saying, get out, get out, get out, it's getting dangerous, you know, they're threatening, you know, sending over, Saddam Hussein is, there are threats of chemical warfare, and they're handing out gas masks to everybody, and everybody has like sealed rooms, and people are leaving, and my parents are hysterical on the phone, come home, you know, you come and visit anyway sometimes, come now, and they're hysterical, come, please come, you know, take the kids and come, you go back afterwards, don't, you know, I really didn't know what to do, I was totally lost, like, what should I do? So my wife and my mother-in-law felt like, you know, this, you know, we're in Israel and we're part of the Israeli people, and we have to do what, you know, everybody else is doing, and we shouldn't leave. And so I'm torn between, you know, my parents and, you know, the honor, midst of honoring your parents, but I have my wife and I have, what do I do? So I went to Rishon Zalman, who was very not mystical and very practical and very, you know, halachic and feet on the ground. And you know, in everything he always, you know, would answer with the lens of halacha. So I went to him, and I told him, you know, my parents, you know, my mother-in-law, my wife, didn't want to go, but my parents, you know, they're crying and honoring your parents, whatever. So he looks at me and he says, you hold that it's dangerous, and you're going to leave the country and leave me behind? If it's dangerous, you're going to leave me here? So how come you're not going to get me out of here? How can you leave? He says, besides, nothing's going to happen anyway. No, don't worry about it. So like, there was no room to argue with that. It was like, no, you stay. Okay, so then 6 months go by, and the whole war goes on, I have entire notebooks of notes that I spoke to him during the war about Shabbos, about leaving radios on, if you put them up when there's a siren, and what to do, and masks, and shaving, and all kinds of different, you know, a whole notebook of things to discuss with them. And, you know, and so when the war was finally over, you know, all of us that were there got a tremendous aliyah in our bitachon Hashem, our trust in Hashem, and our muna and everything. It was one of the most incredible times we've ever had before. You know, being in the yeshiva, and when the siren goes off, and the gentlemen say, stay in the base medrash, and with dependents, there was amazing lessons that were going on. So at the end of the, it was like 6 months later, I went back to him, and the war was over. It was on Purim. I wrote an article once, gas masks and Purim masks. Because the day we actually took our masks off, the war was officially over, was the day before Purim. Purim came the next day. So we had our kids like in a, Tzipi was in a little, the child gas mask, but Benny at the time was in a gas crib. Yeah, a gas crib. You can only put your hand in there with a plastic and get in there, and the crib had a, it was a very, you know, interesting time, and, you know, very. So I went to him and I said, I just want to thank the Rosh Shiva for not letting me leave, because all the incredible growth that we had during this time, I want to thank the Rosh Shiva for. He said, "Yeah, because you said your mother-in-law and your wife didn't want to go." It was like 6 months later, and he gave me this whole thing about, "Oh, you got to leave me," you know. So he knew probably if he said, "Oh, you need to listen to them," it could have caused an argument, you know. So rather than saying, "No, you need to listen to your mother-in-law and your wife," he said, "How can you leave me here?" And So, because he didn't want to cause an argument between us. So he said that. And then now, after it's all over, he said, yeah, because your wife and your mother-in-law didn't want you to go. Besides that, he remembered that 6 months later. But he remembered why he said it that much longer. So, which, who knows how much had happened in between with him and with the whole world, you know. But those are the kind of things that were on his mind. There was one time that my wife, the kids went to America for a couple weeks, so I became this very destitute, poor person, and I went over to Auerbach and said, "My wife's away for Shabbos, and I need a place to a meal for the." I wanted to see what it's like a Shabbos meal like at Auerbach, so I made it like I'm living on the other side of the city, but I have nowhere else to go. Kind of come to the Rosh Hashiva for a meal, so. I wanted to see a Shabbos meal with Rosh Hashiva. It was like a chance to do it. So he said, he feels so terrible. His wife had passed away, and his son and daughter-in-law moved in, and their kids are there, and his daughter-in-law's cooking for him. And he said, I can't invite guests on my daughter-in-law's back. It's not really fair. It feels terrible. I would love to have you come, but I can't do that. So it's not really me to invite anymore. So I said, okay, I understand. So I made a beeline to his son to say, this is what your father said. So he said, no, I'm really, really sorry. But he has so many people flocking him and flooding him all week. He has to have some time that's off limits, and that he has to have some time to rest. And the Shabbos meals are the time that we sort of protect him. And so I felt really bad. So I went to his older brother, Rabbi Israel Auerbach. So I have a friend in Indianapolis who was close to me, and he calls me the Nudge of the generation. So Nudge Hador. So I went to Israel and his older brother, and I told him what happened, and I wanted to go for a meal, and his brother said no. He said, "What are you talking about? Protect him. You go back to him and tell him that you should go." So I went back to him and I said, "Your older brother said he thinks I should come for a meal." So he said, "Okay, well, sometimes like a cousin or whatever will come for Shalosh Shittos. You can come for Shalosh Shittos." So I was really sad. Like, I wanted to see like Kiddush. I wanted to see. So I made a face like Shalosh Shittos. He said, "Shalosh Shittos is also a meal." That's what his son told me. So, okay. So I made up, he said, you'll daven in yeshiva and then you walk home with him. Fine. So that Shabbos, I had a very special Shabbos. All the Rebbeim that I ate with, I stayed in the yeshiva. I slept in the dorm. And Friday night I was with Rav Moshe Halberstam Zatzal, and then Shabbos day with Yossel Tzeber Zatzal. And he said, "Who are you eating by?" I said, "Rav Moshe Halberstam, and now you." And Rav Shlomo Zalman Shal said, "Oh, you're making Shabbos a godel. You're making a great Shabbos." So, and then I walked up to Shari Chesed, to his neighborhood, for Shal Shittos, so for Mincha, Davin Yeshiva. I didn't know, does he know, does he not know, is he happy about him coming out? I didn't know what to do, really. So I just stood there in my place. In the yeshiva, and there was hundreds of guys there. Everybody sort of went out, was starting to walk out Shal Shittos. Rav Shlomo Zalman first started walking down the aisle. He's like looking around the base medrash, and then he says, "Oh, you come with me." Wow. So he called me over. So we're walking down the steps there. So he says to me, "You're coming to eat with me three meals. You're coming to eat three meals at my house." He says, "What do I mean? We call it Shal Shittos. Shal Shittos really means three meals, because and it's in Shulchan Aruch it says Din Shal Shittos. We that's what we say in Yiddish. We say Shal Shittos. It means three meals. It should be Suda Shlishis, the third meal. It's only one meal. It's not three meals." So he says, "So why is it that we call it Shal Shittos?" So I'll tell you why. Walking down the stairs, he's telling me this. I'll tell you why. Because Friday night a person comes home after a long day's work. And maybe they didn't eat so much during that day. And by the time you daven and everything, you get home, you're hungry. So maybe you're eating because you're hungry. Maybe you're not eating because it's such a mitzvah. Shabbos day, a long davening, chazan, whatever. By the time your meal comes around, you're hungry. So you eat. But after two meals like that, who can eat again? Especially on a short Shabbos. So if you eat again, Shal Shittos, that shows retroactively that all the meals you ate were for the sake of heaven. Therefore, we call it Shal Shittos. This one meal sort of turns all the three meals into three meals. So you're coming to eat by me three meals. That's what he said to me. And then we went on and talked about some other things, about the size of the streets in Shari Chesed and other things there. So, and I thought afterwards, okay, that was unsolicited. He said that out of the blue. Now, I know Rosh Hashanah Zalman, and I can tell you exactly what happened. What happened was, his son said, Fried's coming for Shal Shittes. Oh, very nice. And he said, he wanted to come like Friday night, whatever, but I told him, that's you're tired and everything. And then he was sort of sad, but I told him that Shal Shittes is also meal. Why did you tell him that for? Why didn't you let him come Friday night? If that's when he wanted to come, he wanted to be Kiddush and everything, he wanted to see this, why didn't you let him come then? So now he knows that I feel bad I'm going to come Shal Shittes. So walking down the stairs, so he's telling me, you know, you're coming to eat by me three meals. I wasn't there a fly on the wall, but I can guarantee you that's what happened.
Right.
It's exactly, there's no question that that's what, in my mind, that's what happened. So, Anyway, this could go on, sort of go on forever, but these stories. But it shows the incredible sensitivity that he had, the caring of the subtle nuances of every person's feelings to, one time I was there with my mother-in-law. She had a real serious question to ask. And so we came into the house and he needed something, whatever. So in front of my mother-in-law, he made a point to say, could you turn the light on in this other room? You're a Ben Bice here. Like you're sort of like a, what do I say, Ben Bice? I don't know, in English.
Ben Bice.
What?
Yeah, in Hebrew, Ben Bice.
Ben Bite, how would you say that in English?
A member of the family.
You're like a member of the family here, you know. So yeah. You can go turn the light. You don't have to worry. You know, you can do that for me. He made a point of saying that in front of my mother-in-law to make her feel proud that he's saying that. You know, I noticed that he made sure to. He didn't need to say that. You know, he wouldn't have said it if she wouldn't have been. He wouldn't have needed to, whatever. But he for sure said it just to like make her feel good that he said that. So, like I say, the stories go on. There's an amazing, I'll just end with one story and then you can ask if you have any questions or anything, but there's a, when the Sefer came out, Yom Tov Sheni, so I asked him for his approbation, but I knew he didn't give approbation. He stopped giving it for some reason, because for many years he had not written any approbations in any Sefer, because it seems that he once wrote an approbation for somebody that wrote on a certain subject, and a family member of his, he didn't realize was writing a Sefer on the same subject, and because he put an approbation on the one that came out first, the other person felt hurt that now his Sefer is not going to make it because the other one already came out with his approbation. So he felt he hurt somebody with it. So then that was it. He never would write it anymore. Yes. So he couldn't write for Yom Tov Sheni either. So he said, I could write things in his name and all that, but that he proves it obviously. But he said, my words of Torah, that'll be your approbation. The fact that I have words of Torah in there. Anyway, so when I came out with the third edition of it, I was in Dallas already. So I wrote him a letter saying that now that it's been out so many years and it's accepted, maybe now the Rosh Yeshiva could write an approbation. And so he sent back a letter. And also at the time, my daughter Tehila had just been born, and I had spoken to him about the name. And I told him that in the letter I said he was born. I also told how the Kol is doing well, and a lot of people are becoming closer to Yiddishkeit, to Torah. So his son told me that he wrote a response. He doesn't know what he wrote in it, but he wrote a response. I didn't know what exactly it was. So I'm waiting and waiting, and it's not coming. And I called the son a few times. I know he sent it. You know, it's sent. It should be. And it's not. So one day I got some kind of big envelope from the Jewish Federation. And sometimes I just, I look like one of these standard things. I just throw it away. But somehow at first, I ripped it open, and another letter fell out of it from Israel. So it's a letter from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And inside there's a note from the Federation and I look at the address. It said, Rabbi Yochmiel Fried, Dallas, Texas, America. No address. Now, automatically the machine kicks it back. There's no hands involved in these things anymore. But as soon as it said that someone from the Federation said that they got a call from the post office, that there's a letter to a rabbi without an address. Do they know who it is? The Jewish Federation. They said, we do. We'll take care of it. Send it to us. So it arrived miraculously somehow, this crazy thing. And you read it, it's almost like a goodbye letter, and he passed away a week later. In here he writes, first I give you the bracha of Mazel Tov, you and the Rabbanit, your wife, and the birth of your daughter, Tehila Elka, Tizku the Gadla, the Simcha, the Avas Torah, your Shemayim, the Chupa Maisim Tovim, Harbos, Oneg, the Nachas, Mikol HaShelachem, like a whole major bracha. And then he says, he's also very has a lot of hana, a lot of enjoyment from hearing about the success of the Kolel. May you continue to be Marvis Torah, to spread Torah, and Yerushalayim, the fear of heaven, to many people, and to increase the Kavod Shemayim, the honor of heaven, and to bring many, to bring back those that are distant to their Father in heaven. And then he says, regards to somebody, and then he says, as far as the letter that you're asking for, he says, I can't fulfill your request for a number of reasons that I have, which are sort of secret to me. He says, but give thanks to Hashem that you merited this till now, and you should continue to merit many with Torah and with many, many other good, I'm translating as I go along, Chiburim Tovim, other writings, good writings that will help many with Mitoch Harchav V'Simcha, with plenty and with joy. So this got like a week before, so I really got the letter that I wanted. So I put it in, you know, there couldn't be a better letter of Haskama that he didn't write than that. You know, it's basically say, you know, be thankful for what you have and be joyous with it and do much more. So that the letter he said he can't write, he actually wrote, managed to write. Any questions or... Okay, thank you for listening.
Can I ask you one question?
Yeah.
There was great, obviously, great respect between Rosh Hashanah Zalman and Rav Moshe.
Oh, incredible, yeah.
And one was considered...
Rosh Hashanah Zalman told me that yeah. whenever...
Could you talk about that a little bit, that relationship? And...
Yeah, Rosh Hashanah Zalman told me that that whenever Moshe came to America, to Israel, he always came to visit him. And they had incredible reverence for each other that... For example, there's a famous dispute between the two of them that has to do with if cooked food, which is still hot, you're allowed to take it off the fire and then with intention to put it back on the fire, as long as it's completely cooked. So the question was, chont Friday night, a lot of people like some Friday night chont. If there's chicken in the chont, and the chicken is completely cooked, but the bones are not. In Israel, a lot of people eat chicken bones. A lot of people like, you know, it's like a popular thing that's really good. You know, once it's really soft, the chont by the morning. So the question is, if you take it off the fire Friday night, and it's everything else completely cooked but the bones, can you put it back in the fire because the bones are going to cook? Right? So Moshe Feinstein had a responsa that it's perfectly fine. That's not considered food and everything, and he had a long responsa. So Rosh Hashanah Zalman writes, and he has a long response to refute everything that Moshe Feinstein writes, and but he prefaces by saying that I asked the great sage and tzaddik, I asked his permission to be able to write this letter to dispute his view, and he granted his permission, and only with that I will go ahead and write this letter. And basically, they take a tour through every bone throughout Shas, throughout the entire Mishnayos and the entire Gemara, and everything that you know, and that he basically turned over. You know, I could say he had a bone to pick with Rav Feinstein's talk, and he managed to refute like every source that Rav Feinstein had. So Moshe Feinstein wrote back another letter back, you know, to the great sage Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and he refuted the entire tshuva of Rav Shlomo Zalman. Everything back, and he answered up every question he had on him. But despite the fact he answered the entire thing, he said, although I wrote my opinion, and I feel that I've refuted it, however, those who live in Israel, he said, the halacha is like Rosh Hashanah Zalman Auerbach in Israel. And therefore, anything I wrote is only for my country, America, or, you know, outside of Israel, but in Israel, halacha is Rosh Hashanah Zalman Auerbach. The halacha is like him. So, you know, when would you see a professor that refutes another professor and say, but in his university, you know, it should be like him or whatever. It wouldn't find such a thing. But the humility of both of them was legendary, and the respect they had for each other was also legendary.
It's great. Yeah, beautiful.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rabbi Fried.